Now, the modern world, and I use that word with care, the modern world can be a rather confusing place. Now, on the one hand, we have all these wonderful things, the internet, your phone, your investments, your speed, your connectedness, the relentlessness of this life. On the other, pickles and bake-offs, chipped cup austerity, your exquisitely restored terrace home, your beard, your fixie, your mid-century Danish furniture. Aesthetically, architecturally, economically, ideologically, we are a little bit caught between these ruthlessly, instantaneously modern and mistily nostalgic sort of vibes. There has perhaps never been a more disorienting time to be alive. Documenting this moment is Owen Hatherley. Owen is a writer, an architecture critic. His book, The Ministry of Nostalgia. Owen, welcome.
Hi.
At the core of your argument is that poster of which we are all hideously aware, Keep Calm and Carry On. Reading what you have written here, you draw to our attention that it was never, in fact, mass-produced. What a perfect summation of your argument.
Well, it was, I mean, the manner by which it did end up distributed is interesting in that, you know, it didn't really sort of exist in anyone's consciousness apart from historians of the design of that period until maybe like 2007 about the earliest. And then it's basically kind of given, one of the test pressings of it is given along with another load of books to a secondhand bookshop in the north of England. And, you know, then it very, very quickly gets picked up by the Victoria and Albert Museum and then becomes this sort of thing that's always been there, which, of course, it hasn't been.
but that's our moment, isn't it? The things that were always there but, in fact, never quite were, and yet for us in this moment they have a particular presence and significance.
I think something that's sort of been in British life for a very, very long time with this kind of idea about the war held by people that couldn't possibly actually remember the war. We sort of seem in many ways more obsessed by it than the generation that actually did fight through it. And its particular sort of ways of thinking about the world, you know, sort of like us as the sort of brave little island, you know, fighting against the evil continental hordes, something which has, I think, an obvious purchase in Brexit, but also a certain idea of sort of, you know, tightening our belts and making hard choices and having stiff upper lips and so forth, which I think probably seems quite weird to other countries, given how Britain politically tends to make, and certainly in recent years has tended to make, very, very sharp and very, very rash choices. It's not actually been politically a very moderate place for a long time, but it's a sort of self-image that I think is sort of based on a certain idea about the war, and that poster's popularity is a great example of that. It's a sort of idea of the war rather than the actuality of the war.
I mean, that broader sense, though, of that sort of austerity nostalgia. I mean, out here on the trailing fringes of the Anglosphere, we sort of feel something similar. I mean, which goes to your sort of a broader conversation here of this sense we have in this age of extraordinary, well, this bifurcated age of inequality, but at its extreme of extraordinary consumption and the ubiquity of stuff set against this sense of austere nostalgia. It's a strange paradox.
Well, I mean, that's the fun thing about it, is that you can sort of feel nostalgic for an era in which you had less by consuming more.
Yes.
And by sort of consuming particular products that sort of make you feel like you're in an era in which you were poorer than you actually are. I mean, it's sort of remarkably self-serving in a way. It sort of flatters the consumer in a way that can be kind of obnoxious. So you can sort of feel how virtuous you are when you're doing it.
And this sense of this nostalgia, it's a thing we feel in many respects of our lives, but it's transferred into an aesthetic. I mean, it becomes, and it's an interesting example of how in design, in building, in the physical environment that surrounds us is so loaded with meaning, with a sense of this thing that you're talking about.
I mean, in a way, that's about, I think, the way that, you know, the literal value of old housing, you know, after something's been around for a while, it used to decline in value. that was always what happened. You know, by the 1940s, people didn't want to live in Victorian housing. It was falling apart. It was considered fairly wretched. Mm. And they wanted to live in, you know, kind of shiny things made of concrete. And by this point, we've reached the era in which those shiny things made of concrete have sort of first undergone their own sort of period of rejection. And now the things that are being looked on as enormously desirable and fashionable. So, you know, one can make quite a vulgar Marxist argument about it in a way of just being, you know, what's the thing that's not being sold that could be? And in this case, it's that era of housing and that era of design.
Let's look at that thing of housing and design. I mean, and it's sort of splendidly disassociated, as you suggest. And if we go to the gleaming concrete, if we go to the social vision that accompanied that sort of mid-century modernist aesthetic, the aesthetic remains, the social vision is departed.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the sort of transformation of stuff from an era that was completely against sort of trinkets into trinkets is a fantastic example of that. Modernist ornaments being a big thing. Kind of one thing that there's a lot of here, and I don't think it's quite made it that far south yet, but I'm quite sure it will. Of kind of tea towels of modernist buildings, you know, modernist ceremonial mugs, modernist preservation campaigns certainly have got as far as Australia. It's a kind of way of looking at a past that was sort of against these ideas of sort of our wonderful heritage in such a way that's based on heritage culture, which is a contradiction that I don't think people really give enough credit to.
Tell us a bit about how this manifests in architecture, your special subject for 20 points. How does nostalgia manifest there? I mean, in the built environment?
Well, I suppose it's in two ways, really, one of which is the reevaluation of the architecture of the era, which I'm not against. I think the reevaluation of it in many ways quite a good thing. I think that quite a lot of quite decent housing was treated like shit for a long time, and that it's quite a good thing that people are now more sophisticated about it. But going along with that is this, you know, and there's a lot of examples of that stuff then being turned in straightforwardly into luxury flats. And the people that, you know, the idea of what was wrong with that stuff is often seen as the people. There's this kind of idea of, you know, there were these great utopian projects, and then, you know, somehow something went wrong, probably because the wrong kind of people were housed in them. And so there's no real interest in what sort of things that those buildings do now and the sort of people that live in them now and what they might have done with them. Like, you always see these endless kind of photos of, like, depopulated townscapes or of kind of photos from the 60s rather than photos from now. And in terms of new buildings, this sort of varies from place to place, but in London in particular, there's been a lot of new architecture that strains quite hard to look austere. You get these kind of, you know, new concrete blocks of flats that have this sort of half brick of cladding in vaguely Georgian proportions in order for what's usually very high density housing, you know, frequently as a product of sort of transnational consortiums, being sold to look like some sort of historic part of London, which is something that's quite surreal because for most of the last 15 years, it's tried desperately not to look like a part of London.
And yet the fetishizing of stuff which was created as social housing to meet a particular social need and is now passed off, you know, at a premium to people craving that aesthetic, and yet we have a social circumstance that would suggest that social housing is very much required, that its original purpose would be useful. Thank you very much.
Well, yeah, I mean, more than there has been for decades. I mean, a lot of countries, but certainly Britain in particular, are going through really profound housing crises. And to then see the social housing built in that era being sold off and is, you know, incredibly frustrating.
We're talking nostalgia with Owen Hathley because he has a book, The Ministry of Nostalgia. This is Blueprint for Living on RN. And Owen, your book extends this way beyond architecture into many, many realms of the culture. Special words for the likes of Jamie Oliver, for example.
Yeah. Jamie Oliver's mainly in there for something that he did quite a little while ago now, the Ministry of Food. And the Ministry of Food was a sort of TV program and tie-in book where he would be a sort of one-man, you know, kind of benevolent bureaucracy going around schools making people eat proper food.
Keep calm and eat butter.
Exactly, and it sort of begins as this, you know, that initially had quite, didn't entirely have the effects which was intended for its target audience. There's sort of stories of disgruntled parents turning up to the school gates and like handing burgers through the fences at these, you know, kids who've been having to eat like decent, proper, wholesome food. But there's also a sort of another aspect to it, which I think was him sort of trying to popularize kinds of English food which have for a very, very long time been considered pretty gross by sort of I like this kind of stuff, but you know, it was like suet pudding and Yorkshire Yorkshire pudding and dumplings and faggots and things like this, you know,
spotted dick in every home.
Spotted dick, you know, these were standing jokes, not things that you actually ate unless you had to. And he sort of made them cool. And one of the sort of paradoxes of all of this, really, and I think this goes around everywhere, is that these really, really simple kinds of food and drink become the things that are fetishized, like beer and bread, most of all. Like, you know, like everyone's like trying to like make like the best beer and bread, like these really, really, really simple kind of straightforward working class things, just then becoming the kind of object for quite elaborate fetishism and kind of small scale craft production and niche marketing.
But there's an overlay of moralism in that too, is there not? In that fetishizing of the simplicity of the beer and bread and the chipped cup, the sense of the worth of that as a way of living.
Yeah, and in a way, it's sort of, you know, people can be very, very irritating and smug about it, but I mean, there's nothing entirely wrong with like wanting to have nice things. It's just the kind of the sort of self-righteousness that goes along with it can be a bit tiresome.
Retro chic is not a, you know, an unusual thing. Nostalgia, sentimentalism can be, you know, reasonable human responses. But how does this austerity nostalgia differ from other forms of cultural revival? I mean, what does it say about where we are at the moment?
One of the instincts it comes from, I think, is a sort of nostalgia, not necessarily for a better past, but a nostalgia for a better future, as we were sort of talking about a bit at the start.
Nostalgia for an age yet to come, as the great man once said.
Precisely. So there's certain elements of truth in all of this. There's a lot of things about the post-war era that we really wouldn't want back. You know, the levels of racism and misogyny that were off the scale. Young people, if they're honest about themselves, don't actually want to go back and work in steelworks, by and large. You know, these things are not, their absence is not entirely malign, but one of the things that's gone along with that is a sort of abandonment of the idea, in a way that people can actually collectively take control of their own destiny. That you know, that cities can be planned, that governments can exist for people's welfare, that, you know, that business can be controlled and regulated, and generally that the economy can work in the interest of people, and also that it can be understood. You know, there's a lot of belief around at the moment that even understanding the economy is somehow some sort of dated, you know, modernist or socialist idea, and that, you know, that we should instead just enjoy its baffling and unknowable workings. And that kind of era we're talking, you know, so roughly, I guess, from the 30s to 70s here, was very much about people believing that they could control this stuff and they could run it in their own interest and they could run it in a collective interest. And I think people really do feel, in many ways quite rightly, that when this was rejected in the 70s and 80s and 90s, that something really, really important was lost, that, you know, the baby was thrown out of the bathwater. And I broadly agree with that. But I think that the response to that has kind of been on the terms of that kind of consumerist world that came to replace it. It's been like, how can we bring that era back? Well, by consuming its stuff. And by making stuff that's like that era stuff, which is kind of point missing.
Is there and I'm thinking particularly of buildings, I'm guessing, in this, but is there sort of an aesthetic exhaustion in this? Are we stuck for an idea?
Well, I think in architecture, for instance, it's actually a reaction to a kind of futurism. Like, you know, it's a reaction against architects like Zaha Hadid and Patrick Schumacher or Rem Koolhaas, and, you know, this kind of very, very sort of ambitious, computer-engineered, non-orthogonal iconic architecture that I think people were sort of, after a while, started to find rather vacuous and sort of flashy and meaningless. And so, you know, the things that became fashionable in architecture in about the last 5-6 years were all the things that were opposite to this, things that weren't computer-aided, that were designed with, like, obvious materials rather than the sort of generic shiny cladding, where you could sort of see what it was made of and see how it was produced. It was not because there weren't enough ideas in architecture in terms of form. There were huge amounts of ideas in architecture in terms of form. It's just there weren't really any sort of social ideas that people found interesting. And the ideas about the city were, you know, often enormously depressing. I mean, Zaha Hadid's partner, Patrick Schumacher's, you know, kind of notorious for, you know, what we should do if the city is privatize everything and build on Hyde Park. And I often sort of think that he's in many ways a sort of talented satirist, that, you know, what he's trying to do there is kind of, this is the logical conclusion of what's happening. See if you like
it. Urban design and satire is a wonderful thought.
I think it kind of is. He'd deny it, of course. But, you know, that it's quite a frightening world. You know, that in many ways, you know, Dubai is frightening. And I think people are probably right to be frightened by it. So, in many ways, it's a sort of revulsion against a kind of futurism of the status quo, really, or a sort of futurism that's heading towards somewhere that we don't control and we don't know where it's going, and we can see that it's doing enormous social damage, and that we kind of, you know, have to slap on the brakes in many ways.
Which in itself is sort of a healthy impulse, and yet...
Yeah, it is.
But it's been appropriated in a political sense, I guess, in this sort of post-liberal vacuum that, you know, that politics and so forth wants us to dwell on this past as a sense of security in a very uncertain present. I mean, that is perhaps a less healthy aspect.
Yeah, absolutely. But you can see those impulses going into all sorts of different arenas that, you know, that someone said on one of the social networks a couple of days ago, I can't remember who it is, so I can't give them the credit, that, you know, everyone at the moment wants it to be the 50s. There's a sort of left version of the 50s, and there's a kind of right-wing version of the 50s in America where, you know, you know, we still make stuff, and China's still a peasant country and isn't making stuff instead of, you know, that and the blacks are kept down and so forth. You know, that there's a kind of... And obviously, then there's the social democratic 50s of equality and social provision and modernist architecture. And they're all kind of about thinking that something went wrong in the 60s and 70s. And I think they probably disagree on what that thing is. But I think that's actually the sort of austerity nostalgia of some kind, of 50s nostalgia of some kind, is remarkably common across the political spectrum.
What do you think that thing was that went wrong?
Well, I mean, I'm obviously going to, you know, I'm going to give the left-wing answer. I'm going to give the answer, you know, that I think that the total rejection of state provision was foolish. The rejection of things like public housing was fairly foolish, and that the privatization of many public goods, you know, hasn't done anybody apart from the shareholders any good. I mean, I genuinely believe this, but maybe that's my austerity nostalgia talking.
Owen, thank you. That has been a wonderful little journey and some very, very provoking ideas. Thank you.
Thank you.
Owen Hatherley, he's a writer, he's an architecture critic. His book, Seek It Out, Some Wonderful Thoughts, is The Ministry of Nostalgia. This is Blueprint for Living here on RN.